suffering is diminished. The end point of it all for Krishna, Patanjali and Buddha is for us to attain liberation or illumination of the mind, which leads to choices that create peace and equanimity for ourselves and for others. The management of the mind needs wisdom as its fuel. In the West, we usually reach for new knowledge, burying ourselves deeper in information, without realizing that we are already full of thoughts and words and opinions, but light on wisdom. Thinking tends to enmesh us in more thoughts, deepening the mire of confusion rather than lessening it. Wisdom is not a result of thoughts and philosophy. Rather, it comes as insight gained from direct experience about how life works, applied to our own lives. The Bhagavad Gita prescribes a way through yogic practice to be free from mental anguish and suffering. It serves as both an ancient and compelling story of Krishna leading Arjuna into battle, and a spiritual text on the inner struggle for self-mastery and the attainment of happiness through yoga. The story of the Gita begins on a battlefield, at the cusp of a colossal war between two large families, the Kauravas and Arjuna's family, the Pandavas. The families are mired in the hatred and mistrust that the grasping of inheritance and assets can bring. Arjuna is distraught as he looks across the battle lines. He knows that by engaging in this war, hundreds of family members and friends will be lost on both sides of the fight. Arjuna is faced with a personal and ethical crisis, which he is unwilling and unable to solve. Krishna is a childhood friend of Arjuna's, and with his spiritual powers as an incarnation of the Hindu Lord Vishnu, he has a broader view of the need for Arjuna to experience the suffering of battle to discover his true nature of self. The resulting conversation between Arjuna and Krishna is used as a discourse on the purpose of one's life and the path of yoga as a tool to unravel the type of paralyzing anguish that Arjuna is experiencing. Krishna is conveying a solution both allegorical and practical for Arjuna, and all readers who are similarly faced with paralyzing and seemingly intractable problems. The sage Patanjali also promoted mastery of the mind as an essential practice towards pure awareness of the perfection of our own divinity. What Patanjali was prescribing was not more learning or more religion. He simply presented a training program of practice to release us from the pains of being human. Buddha had his own training program, which looked remarkably like Patanjali's. Clean and empty the mind with meditation, release yourself from false perceptions, still down, and witness your own perfection and innate wisdom as a path to assist all others to reach enlightenment. Krishna recommended meditation and action, which I have adopted for the yoga of business. Such meditation, Krishna admits in the Gita, is difficult, but growth mindset style, one can achieve it through sustained effort. The yogi must learn to meditate continually and make their mind one-pointed, restricting any extraneous thoughts or sensual distractions. The yogi should practice such meditation for their own purification only, without any ulterior motive. This contemplative form of yoga, systematized in Patanjali's eight limbs, is the form of yoga that is ultimately going to control the mind. The point of giving all of this background to the Yoga Sutras, Gita, and the teachings of the Buddha is to underscore that the afflictions that trouble us today are not new. They're not even a little bit retro. They are positively ancient and have been exhibited by humans across continents throughout recorded history. I see this as a relieving and motivating fact. In the quest to lose the eye of the ego and merge into greater loving consciousness with all my fellow humans, it is good to know that we, in this current generation, are not alone in feeling the way we do. We have not caused the downfall of happiness with the interwebs or lost the capacity for loving awareness over the last century, although we have given it a pretty good shot. We are simply in the present, in the thick of it, and, because of our own limited perceptions and raging egos, are taking full ownership of it, reactively and painfully. Each epoch no doubt had their own version of where we are now, and at the precipice of their despair, it would have felt like the darkest hour. What happens in Samvega? Buddhists have a word to describe the place of seeking that I suspect will be an aha moment of relief in your self-diagnosis. It certainly was for me when I came across it in author and yogi Stephen Cope's excellent book, The Wisdom of Yoga. That word is Samvega. Cope, quoting Buddhist monk Thanissaro Bhikkhu, describes Samvega as three clusters of feelings occurring simultaneously: shock, alienation, and dismay at the futility and meaninglessness of life. This manifests as a sense of our own culpability, complacency, and to a degree, foolishness in being so blind to this situation, and a sense of anxiety coupled with urgency to get out of this messy, meaningless cycle and evolve to a new level of meaning and awareness. Sound familiar? I'm surprised that Samvega doesn't get more of a run in the adoption of Buddhism in the West. We can't turn round without hearing the word mindfulness, which of course is a great thing for mainstreaming meditation. But having the language to describe the cluster of despair, futility and urgency for change that Samvega brings us would be a salve when the road gets rough for many of us. Samvega is linked to the moment when we see the material aspirations to be empty in their capacity to deliver lasting happiness or true satisfaction. This is usually a radical realization and one that deconstructs everything that we have been raised on and worked towards, the messages of our culture and marketing experts, and the narratives about ourselves we have bought into. It is an unraveling that is swift, deep, and awkward. Samvega is uncomfortable and is probably akin to what we would describe as a midlife crisis. It is aptly a product of midlife. As in early life, we are striving to get to the fun bit where all the work and suffering pay off. By midlife, we suddenly realize there's no one coming to save us. The usual demonstration of this trio of dismay is a desperate acquisition of new items of desire, such as sports cars, new breasts, or younger partners, followed by a penchant for numbing substances. I hazard there is a less visible cohort of people who, when they hit this period, don't consume to relieve the pain, but are driven to turn within and look for guidance on how to access their true nature of self. We want to become quiet, away from all the noise that has masked the early squeaks and clanks of the wheels beginning to fall off. Where midlife crisis in the Western context implies breakdown, shame and public humiliation, and a gradual acceptance of the inevitability of death and aging, Samvega, in contrast, is a necessary and welcome step to awareness. We can't go from zero to awake at the speed of light. All of the processes outlined in the Gita, the Noble Truths and the Eight Limbs of the Yoga Sutras, are undertaken as a practice over time, once the awareness of the false perceptions of objects as happiness has occurred. Rather than being a state of emergency, it is a stage of emergence. It is at this point of meeting Samvega that many of us start to seriously look at what we are doing with our lives and wondering whether we could do more that is meaningful and feeds our souls. The answer, of course, is yes. The answer is starting a good hustle, and your questioning why and how is the underpinning motivation of this book. Samvega appears in Buddhist teachings and was also referenced by Patanjali in the first chapter of the sutras. He could obviously see that this emergence of awareness was the catalyst for change. He characterizes it as a vehement determination to find our way out of suffering. This vehemence is required to muster the necessary passion to catapult oneself out of the road of crisis and stasis into action and change, even if that action is initially undertaken in a quiet and still form like meditation. I vividly remember reading the chapter in Stephen Cope's book where I first met Samvega. I was in India, in Rishikesh, at a very damp, mouldy ashram overlooking the Ganges. After a couple of torrid days of welcome to India gastro, I wobbled outside and forded the stream of sadhus with their hands out for alms. Desperate to eat a piece of solid food, I saw in front of me, like a mirage, a German bakery. Next to the bakery was a bookstore with plenty of bootleg English language titles, and The Wisdom of Yoga grabbed my attention in my weakened state of seeking. As I read the description of Samvega, It completely reflected the feeling I'd had for a couple of frustrating years before I left my formal executive roles. A combination of deep anger-fueled frustration, of anguish about the futility, and is this all there isness about my life? And the increasingly hysterical cries from my heart to be shown that this wasn't what my precious life was going to deliver to the world. I felt trapped, and in me was the growing kernel of determination to find my way out of the pointlessness of my suffering. My difficulty was that I was trying to think my way out of a problem that lived in my mind. I was the embodiment of knowledge without wisdom. It seems pretty funny now. I suspect many of us do enlightenment like this, as we huff and puff through endless sun salutations and strive for yogic prowess while our minds whir like crazy, creating more problems to solve. The expression first world problems is really our self-deprecating way of acknowledging that we are culturally experiencing Samvega. Our wealth, craving, attachment and meaningless existence flash up on the billboard of our day-to-day lives and we don't like what we see. So we trivialize it with a throwaway line and return to being the life of a party that we aren't quite sure we wanted to stay at quite so long. The problem with the Western experience of Samvega is the amplification of ridiculousness when you are in a mire of misery surrounded by wealth. It's hard to whine, "There must be more than this," when there's ample coverage of all basic and not so basic needs. We are buried underneath our things, often piling more fuel of possessions and material goods onto a fire that is already a raging inferno. What would extinguish the fire? Only the cooling stillness of turning in, shutting the eyes, removing the stimulus, and beginning the long, slow process of decoupling from those false perceptions. Part 4. The Yoga of Business. It is better to fail at your own dharma than succeed at the dharma of someone else. Krishna, Bhagavad Gita. Especially when on that nervous, excited cusp of starting something new, the temptation is to wallow in endless learning. Women are repeat offenders in believing that they need more and more knowledge to be able to successfully execute a business idea. You have to look out for the point at which the quest for knowledge becomes a safe haven for doing nothing and avoiding wisdom. When all the books are read, podcasts are listened to, blogs are scanned, and tweets and posts consumed, there is a point at which you have to rely on your own wisdom and begin. Now, the teachings of yoga. And so begins the opening line of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. It's simple and profound, with an almost theatrical flourish. In this final section of The Good Hustle, it's time to delve into the 8 limbs of yoga, as prescribed by Patanjali, and link them to our progress along the pathway to creating a good hustle of our own. You may feel somewhat overwhelmed right about now. Your newly diagnosed Samvega is no doubt in overdrive. And as you look across your life, over the piles of people, things, responsibilities, to-dos and should-haves, you may well feel that a new business, or even just an idea, will be the butterfly's wing that sets off the avalanche you've been narrowly avoiding. This is how you should feel, as you are metaphorically at the rubbish dump, witnessing the massive yellow excavator plow through the trash of your mind accumulated over a lifetime. You will no doubt be clinging strongly in places to your favourite bits. As I said at the outset, the heavy lifting for becoming a modern yogi in life and in business is all in the mindset. The rest flows gently from the establishment of good practices, keeping in mind the mind is everything. The first step at the beginning of your good hustle is to investigate the difference between a good hustle and a bad good hustle. What's a good idea? The process of ideation, especially when it comes to creating a meaningful life that delivers service and value to the world, is a sequential process. The idea has to be created. It has to have compelling commercial potential, even and especially if it is applied to a social good where the impact will be more valuable than ever. You have to be able to identify a market for the idea, and you have to be able to deliver it to that market in a way that is suitable and simple. On a personal level, you have to be able to manage risk and have a business model that combines your idea with the skills needed to realize it. You also need to have the capacity to source or generate adequate funding to keep you and your business afloat until sufficient revenue kicks in. These steps, as I'll demonstrate in the following pages, can work in tandem with your personal journey through Patanjali's 8 limbs of yoga. This work is infinitely easier when you have the structure of ethical and moral guidance that Being Yogi delivers, along with the capacity to surrender to your internal divinity, your ancient wisdom, and your sense of what will serve others best, without diminishing your own capacity for happiness and peace. Meet the Ashtangas. To help you grasp and assimilate the 8 limbs of yoga, as outlined by Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras, I'm going to link them to the process of taking an idea from concept to market entry. But first, let's meet the Ashtanga family. The Ashta, 8, Anga, limbs of yoga basically act as guidelines on how to live a meaningful and purposeful life. Beginning with Yama, restraints, then followed by Niyama, observances, Asana, postures, Pranayama, breathing, Pratyahara, turning within, Dharana, concentration, Dhyana, meditation, and Samadhi, union with the divine. The 8 limbs are laid out as though you are walking along an overgrown path and finding new clues in a treasure hunt to discover your own true nature of self. While they look linear to our Western way of thinking, you may of course backtrack or head up an unmarked path, or camp out for a while at a spot where you feel comfortable before you set off again. You may want to light a flare and get airlifted out at moments where you feel your comfort zone being grossly infringed. But once the light is shone a little further in front of you, you will want to keep exploring, as your curiosity will light up, and you will want to know what is around that next limb. The 8 limbs of yoga provide an incredibly handy set of guidelines to work with, and if you use them as such, they become an invaluable framework of values and actions for your good hustle to begin, to flourish, and to benefit others. Number 1, the Yamas. The first limb, Yama, which has 5 sublimbs, deals with our ethical standards and sense of integrity, focusing on our behavior and how we conduct ourselves. Yamas are also known as the restraints and relate to our engagement with the external world. The Yamas act as a clearing and cleaning tool on the path to Dharma being revealed. It's important that the contemporary context for who and how we are today in our Western condition is woven into the Yamas. This softens the precepts and makes them more accessible to our daily experience. Both the Yamas and Niyamas, or observances, serve as a prescription for moral and ethical conduct and self-discipline, and they help us to acknowledge the spiritual aspects of our nature. There are 5 Yamas: Ahimsa, non-violence; Satya, truthfulness; Asteya, non-stealing; Brahmacharya, continence, chastity; and Aparigraha, non-covetousness or non-grasping. Don't let the unfamiliar Sanskrit words distract you from their message. In a growth mindset way, it's just more fun language for you to learn and grow your brain with. Ahimsa. Ahimsa is a relatively common understanding in and outside of yoga circles. Translated as non-violence, it can be widely interpreted, from mindfulness with every step so as not to harm a tiny insect under our feet, to conscious eating with the welfare of all living creatures in mind, to the avoidance of combat with our fellow humans. When you are thinking sentient beings and your duty of care, this is ahimsa in action. As with all the yamas, ahimsa is completely subjective, and what is right and non-violent for you isn't necessarily the prescription to live by for another. There is an element of ahimsa, however, that is rarely spoken about, which is fundamental to so much human suffering and attachment: non-violence towards ourselves. While we are busting a gut to step over ants and eat cruelty-free products, we are self-criticizing, self-hating, self-harming, and running a 24/7 negative soundtrack inside our heads. In workshops and Q&A sessions, I spend a lot of time calling people out on questions that start with, "This is a dumb question," which of course is code for, "I am dumb." It lodges like a shard of glass every time I hear the implicit self-deprecation used to demean and diminish out of the mouths of people who are walking around in a miasma of internal loathing. In one session, I had a student asking me about building a personal brand. She was concerned that no one would come to her yoga classes when she graduated from her teacher training because, as she put it, she has such a boring and ordinary name. She wanted to know if she should change her name. She so obviously saw herself as invisible and forgettable and assumed that this was the world's experience of her too. That is a perfect example of violence by stealth. We are so used to hearing our own inner critic that we don't have an awareness of the damage we are doing to ourselves. I mentioned earlier the personal struggle I had with not feeling good enough and the resulting need to overachieve. I remember lying in bed the night I was awarded my PhD and sobbing into my pillow. I'd achieved the highest possible academic qualification I could get, and I'd completed it in under 3 years while working in a demanding executive role. It should have been an occasion to celebrate the heights of what can be done with hard work, discipline, and willpower. But instead, it brought the startling realization that I still felt unworthy and unfulfilled. That's Dr. Unworthy to you. Happily, the absurdity of this behavior was a moment that truly rang alarm bells for me. It forced me to turn in and start the process of making peace with my Sambhaga, to look for a happiness that wasn't based on thankless striving and craving approval from some external authority. Ahimsa begins at home, and before you can good hustle for others, there has to be self-love and compassion. New business endeavors and making the leap into pursuing your Dharma can be fraught with brutal criticism. There are standard limiting beliefs that I see and hear so often. The most common is that no one would be interested in what the business is going to do or say or sell. Of course, that attitude is also underpinned by the familiar adversary of unworthiness, which is strongly linked to comparison and judgment. If you are posing the question, "Why me?" you are simultaneously asking, "Why not them?" and comparing yourself to a faceless competitor that embodies all of the attributes you believe you lack. Before you have even committed your idea to paper or screen, you're writing it off, handing over your power and prowess to something or someone who doesn't even exist. It's madness, but it's common madness. With that level of self-doubt, the first naysayer you share your idea with is enough to send you scurrying back into your negative self-belief system. Satya. Which leads us into the second yama, Satya, or truth. You need to make a commitment to yourself to not only not harm, but also to tell the truth. In her excellent book, Fierce Medicine, yoga teacher Anna Forrest devotes a whole chapter to what she calls truth speaking. Forrest defines this as speaking from the heart and telling the truth with compassion. Many of us have lost the art of truth speaking. I'm not saying that we are lying our way through our days and nights, but rather that we have so much fear and so many filters that we look to say what we want people to hear, rather than what would be the kind or compassionate thing to say to them. Truth speaking asks us to firstly open our hearts. There needs to be some preparatory work beforehand to ensure that our heart, once open, is resilient. We need to know, trust, and love ourselves before our truth speaking, as we also have to be able to hear it from others. If you have an active self-critic and a dry reservoir of self-love, you can't pour onto another what you aren't able to give or receive yourself. All too often, words are used as weapons. It takes time and discipline to turn that pattern off. We are cruel with words to be funny, to be defensive, to be liked and approved of, to lash out or back, or simply because we lack awareness and compassion. Truth speaking has to have a trifold target of ourselves, the person we are speaking to, and the situation, and all need compassion within them. There are many times that the best truth speaking is silently witnessing someone else's pain with love and empathy, and not giving them the benefit of your wisdom. These are the times when the truth is that they have to work through their own stuff. Your power is in compassion and simply being present and honoring what they are going through. This is a beautiful yogic practice, and actively seeking opportunities to listen without judgment is an abundant training ground. Truth speaking for justice is a much needed intervention and is often a frightening exposure to power and the force of public or majority opinion. As a good hustler, this will be a lightning rod for you, as your practice will be based on working and sometimes fighting for something that is bigger than you, for the greater good of humanity. Sure, this is subjective, and whenever there's a division of public sentiment on a matter, there's an equally passionate argument from the opposite side as to why they are right. Hello, wars. Truth speaking here is not about winning the argument or hating the opposition. It's about standing up for what you believe in. That may just be a matter of not letting a sexist, racist, discriminatory or unkind comment pass without asking the speaker not to make those comments in front of you as you find them offensive. We often choose to stay silent because it's easier, or we don't want to become the target ourselves, or we are frightened that it might impact our careers or what people think and say about us. And the answer is yes, it might. By voicing your truth in a compassionate way, you are acknowledging the speaker, the victim, and your own truth. Whether or not the acid is turned on you is irrelevant. Your path to enlightenment, or even a good night's sleep and a clear conscience, must have truth in its DNA. It's about the broader commitment to humanity and your own commitment to living as your perfect and divine self. A good hustle is built on the scaffolds of self-awareness, and it's usually pretty clear when you need to speak up. You can feel that voice welling up in your gut, dying to burst out, if it can only get past the fear filter in your throat. Satya in creating your good hustle is of premium importance, as like with all relationships, complexities escalate quickly when there's money and risk at stake. By not identifying when you are uncomfortable with a proposal or the ethics or motives of someone you are dealing with, you are silencing that inner compass that you are working so hard to polish and give a voice to. When starting a new business, everyone is an expert, and you'll get a truckload of advice along the way. This isn't a bad thing, as the early conversations, especially the ones with potential customers, are essential for refining what you're doing. What you may find in many conversations, and be surprised by, are the strong voices of criticism, doom, gloom, and caution. Unless what you're doing is truly high risk, not just to you but to others, and the concern is genuine truth speaking, you know, mortgaging the house again for a highly speculative Ponzi scheme, then often the truth coming your way arises from the speaker's own fear or previous life experience, or a desire but inability to do exactly what you're doing. Be wary of your reaction to these conversations, and always listen for your own truth. There is a point in the process where you must just begin. Assuming you're conducting your own risk management and due diligence and putting your idea through its paces before you bet everything on black, the combination of knowledge and skills plus heart and gut should give you all of the answers you need. If you believe there is no clear and present danger and that the benefits to you of having a go, even if you fail, are more compelling than where you are currently at, then nothing should hold you back. If you're continually getting advice that there is a flaw in your business model, but you believe you can overcome it and push on, then you are making and owning that decision, and it's part of your karma. Ultimately, whatever the outcome, you will have actively chosen the journey. A stayer. The third precept of the Yamas, a stayer, or non-stealing, seems a little more cut and dried. Or is it? Stealing can be material. Beyond the material, however, especially in relation to the journey of our good hustles from idea to reality, we can apply a stayer to a number of key points along the way. It's often said that there is nothing new in the world, inferring that we live in a space of continual reinvention, solving and improving on the eternal and repetitive problems of humanity. This suggests that there are few opportunities to truly come up with an idea for something that is unique. The definition of innovation is bringing something new and transformational to an existing idea. And in the main, this is what we build on with new ideas. When you bring your new idea into the light of day, you have a responsibility to ensure that you aren't inadvertently infringing on the rights of any existing products, services, or brands. This is easily done with the power of a search engine or the use of trained professionals in the case of checking for brand and trade infringements or patent searches. It may well be that someone else is doing exactly what you want to do, But your innovation is that it is new to your area, jurisdiction or country. All good, no theft there. It may well be that you can reach out to whomever is doing what you want to do and get their help and advice as you start your own journey. Never underestimate the power of entrepreneurs to support others. It is quite common in the excitement of beginning to turn your idea into a business to inadvertently ignore or overlook this yama. I'm as guilty as the next person of doing little projects off the side of my desk and never really thinking about who's paying for my side hustle. When I worked in large government departments and well-funded universities, this seemed to be okay, and I had almost a sense of entitlement. I believed that the hard work and endless sweat I put into my job had earned me some invisible credits that allowed me to clock onto my own work every so often, and maybe even do a little printing. I know, right? It's trivial and we all do it. But that isn't the point. When the yogi antenna is tuned well, this is stealing, no matter how we might like to justify it. And we need to be mindful and apply some satya to the justification. You can see how even small acts are part of the fabric of ethics and right living. The point isn't who knows or cares. The point is that we know and care and say no. In your quest to get your good hustle on, consider how that might work for you. Maybe the first step, if you're nervous about leaping into starting a business, is to approach your employer and see how they feel about enabling some creative time for employees. Some businesses, following the lead of companies like Google and Pixar, allow a regular allotment of time for employees to undertake their own projects every week. Look for opportunities to try out the signs you are on your Dharma path without taking away from what you are being paid to do. Want to teach yoga? Great. Offer to run lunchtime classes for your stressed out workmates in the boardroom in exchange for a gold coin donation to charity. Want to work in organics or run a food truck? Too easy. Get approval to have some urban food gardens set up within your offices, or set up a lunchtime food supply for co-workers to raise money for office social activities or charity. Love crafting and dream of a social enterprise? Organize a meetup with your co-workers and see how many of them are avid knitters, spinners or scrapbookers who have been yearning for a peer group and you will have just provided one, with an on-site Christmas makers market opportunity for all your gorgeous outputs to be sold. Another area where you can easily become guilty of inadvertent stealing is when seeking advice from other people. All of us tend to indulge in it when we're at the low cash, high need part of our business idea development. I'm asked nearly every day to have coffee with someone so they can run something past me or pick my brain. I used to think that it was part of my karma yoga to meet up and have these conversations, but it didn't take long to realize that this was really cutting into my own work time. The answer was solved with love, compassion, and clear boundaries. I stopped having coffee, and instead I now offer to review an idea pitch by email and give some advice on the next steps, ensuring I give value and let them know what the costs of the next steps are. It also enables them to understand that they have to invest in their ideas from the beginning. And I say no a lot too. I also allocate an amount of time to pro bono work with social enterprises, not-for-profits, or brilliant good hustle ideas that I want to play with. When asking others for help, especially those who do it for a living, remember that everyone has a value, and if you need to ask for it for free, then make a loving gesture of acknowledgement to say thank you. The final area where you may need to look at how you can use the yama of a stayer is linked to the same way ahimsa is applied to self-harm. What emotional patterns are you getting stuck in or hanging on to that are robbing you of happiness? Is it anxiety? Is it fear? Is it jealousy? Is it shame and regret? Is it pride and reputational attachment? All of these feelings steal joy and keep you stuck in the past or terrified of the future, rather than settled, at peace and at one in the present. Think about where you can put a stayer to work in your life and make a commitment to focus on that area in your meditation, yoga, and mind management. Root out the cause and the effect from your mind and on your life. Bring these feelings into your meditation and yoga and work through them on the mat and on the cushion. Stop resisting them and embrace them as part of you with the disarmament of self-love and compassion. This is theft that is not just daylight, but 24/7 robbery, and only you can apprehend the offender. Brahmacharya. The fourth yama is always a beauty to discuss, guaranteed to elicit awkward shoe staring or, if you're like me, immature giggling and juvenile comments. Brahmacharya, or chastity, is a great example of how social shifts from Patanjali's time to the modern context change the intention of the Ashtanga yoga system in word, if not in deed. Chastity was a given if you were going to be a renunciate yogi, and still is for the sannyasins, babas, sadhus, monks, bhikkhus and nuns who take on a holistic commitment to their spiritual path. In Sanskrit, Brahma means higher awareness, and acharya means to live in. Brahmacharya, therefore, means to move, learn and live in higher awareness. For the stricter religious and non-sectarian definition, brahmacharya means complete control over or abstinence from sexual interactions. I believe that there is a compatibility, however, with contemporary practice. Like the divine itself, there are many ways to incorporate and understand brahmacharya in the spirit of living in higher awareness. In the Buddhist monastic tradition, celibacy is a method of dealing with desire. In his book, Work, Sex, Money, Real Life on the Path of Mindfulness, Chogyam Trungpa describes celibacy as not designed to repress desire, but to examine the mental aspect of it. He goes on to explain that physical expression is an extension of mental desire, so sort out the mind and the body will follow. Once the desire is understood, the heat goes out of it as something that can distract and derail your mind from what you are trying to achieve. Monastics are using their sexual energy for spiritual purposes. In the period of aligning your mind, instilling discipline, and focusing on your business idea, this is an option as part of repurposing your energies into the single pointed goal of your good hustle. If you aren't quite ready to get that serious about your business, remember, I am a method yogi. I think the idea of brahmacharya is worth considering in a world that is gorging itself on sexualized images and low self-esteem. The way I see brahmacharya in our context feeds entirely and logically into the progression from non-violence to truth to non-stealing. Sex outside of committed loving relationships is frequently used as a gateway activity to the future promise of love or simply as a way of receiving attention and approval. Let me be perfectly clear that I'm not implying that sex outside of marriage or relationships is a bad thing. Decades of feminist fighting for the right to have pleasure on our terms has been a good thing. The collective eroding of women's self-esteem that seems to have quietly happened alongside increased sexual freedom, however, means that sex can be an agent of violence and theft and benefits enormously from being reframed against Patanjali's eight limbs. Approaching this from a Buddhist perspective on attachment and non-attachment is another way to think about your relationship to sex and thus its impact on your mind and emotions. You can ask yourself the question, does or will engaging in sex at this time with this being cause me suffering? The idea of attachment here is not whether the act causes you physical pain, see a doctor, but whether the emotions, reactions, and expectations of sex or love leave you with an attachment or craving or aversion that causes suffering. The answer may be no, that you can within or outside of a loving relationship have sexual interactions that leave you neither attached to the pleasure nor suffering in any way. I think we've established that before you can get down to business, you need to attend to the discipline of mind and surrender and acceptance of your own perfection, exactly as you are right now. The search for love from an external other is a big distraction and can significantly derail the real search for love that's undertaken within. No matter how fantastic a partner appears, without mind control and self-love conquered on your side, that other person is going to have to go through it all with you and potentially be the recipient of a lot of acting out as you grow. Now, maybe that's okay and part of their karmic path with you and for themselves. But it also may be better to turn your love light down and get down to the business of working on your mind so when the divine comes knocking, you are ready to entertain. A parigraha. We end the yamas with a parigraha, which translates in a number of ways, including non-greed, non-possessiveness and non-attachment. The prefix a means non, pari means on all sides, and the word graha means to take, to seize or to grab. This important yama teaches us to take only what we need, keep only what serves us in the moment, and to let go when the time is right. For entrepreneurs, it reminds us that our endeavors only have to yield enough, that the game is actually about working towards something that provides service and benefit while covering our needs and contributing to the well-being of others. We don't need to hustle to accrue. We simply need to be sustainable and conscious. Aparigraha is actually one of the central messages in the Bhagavad Gita, in which Krishna shares with Arjuna one of the teachings that could perhaps be the most important lesson of all to learn. Let your concern be with action alone and never with the fruits of action. Do not let the results of action be your motive. How often do we worry so much about what might come of the effort we put into a project at work that we never really enjoy the work itself? So often we worry if we'll be successful enough or good enough when we put our hearts on the line to show the world what we're made of, that we forget why we started in the first place. The essential point here is that we should never concern ourselves with the outcome of a situation. We should only concern ourselves with what we're actually doing right now as we work towards that outcome. Staying present and in the moment is fundamental to the Ashtanga Yoga system. The end of the Yamas and the beginning of the Niyamas is asking us to release control while knowing that we have a very clear set of moral guidelines that can be applied as a template to what we do and how we do it. Does whatever it is you are interrogating in your life currently fit within that paradigm? If so, surrender and proceed with yogi abandon. Number 2, the Niyamas. Niyama, the second limb of Ashtanga, means observances. These are recommended activities and habits for healthy living, spiritual enlightenment, and a liberated state of existence. The Niyamas tend to be activities that are more turned inwards. They are self-reflective tools that allow us to deepen our understanding of the yogic path and our place on it. Their focus is being rather than doing. As the Yamas and Niyamas are some of the building blocks of your yogic practice, it is essential that they are part of the integrated thinking of how you approach things, rather than you seeing your spiritual life as separate from your greater living and working. Like the Yamas, there are 5 Niyamas or observances to master in your yogi skill set. I'm again going to link them to the process of thinking about your good hustle. They are Socha, cleanliness, Santosha, contentment, Tapas, austerity, Svadhyaya, self-study, and Ishvara Pranidhana, union with the divine. Socha. The Niyamas begin with Socha, or cleanliness, which can be applied in a literal approach as regular bathing and keeping your surroundings clean and tidy. It can also be used metaphorically in terms of the state of your mind and actions. Undoubtedly, personal hygiene was of utmost importance to yogis and householders and featured in the daily pre- and post-prayer and meditation ritual. It was seen as a mark of respect and worship. The split between socha as both metaphorical and applied remains relevant to our contemporary practice. I would hazard that we are frantically sanitizing our surfaces and fighting against germs because our minds are so full of compost, and it is easier to work with what is outside than get into our innermost trash and do the difficult work. There is, as yet, no wipe invented that can do the work of sanitizing the mind. It is our minds that need to be tamed, cleaned of their grasping and attachment to sense pleasures, and then situated in the present. Think of your mind as a work surface. If you are struggling to find space with piles of mess around you, it's going to be much harder to sit down and focus on the task at hand. As we are preparing for understanding our path and working on our good hustle concepts, the process of getting a stable and clean workspace is a daily task. As with any big cleanup, it is hideous at first. It feels overwhelming, and with every piece of junk you throw out, you discover hidden repositories of new rubbish to deal with. It is a tough, visceral process that makes you want to simply shut the door and leave it for another time. The tip for pushing on is to continually chip away at the pile. Remember, you have control over this process, and you own all the crap. The classic hallmark of hoarders is the inability to emotionally release all of their possessions. The mess ends up owning you, and therefore it is incumbent on you to shift the power paradigm and get back on top. You're the boss. The anatomy of a thought, a pattern, an emotional response is an interesting concept. It is hard for us to initially conceive that feelings and thoughts are habits, not reality. We feel something once in a particular set of circumstances. Let's say someone is nice to us. We then feel good when we next see that person, as we associate them with not feeling bad. That nice feeling was previously learned when we encountered it in a positive situation, and so on and so on. The feeling is not a thing within itself. We think feelings are real, and we think they come from the body. They aren't and they don't. They are simply an artifact of our minds. We make them, and we can change them. We store events and our reactions to them in our emotional sponge, like a repository to keep amplifying and morphing the good and the bad into their distinct categories. Even the act of cleaning out your mind gets a tag attached, most likely bad, so you are resisting and reacting even before you get to the act of doing. But what if you approach these mind messes as simply neutral? Not good, not bad, a task to be done, which if fully present in the moment simply involves some conscious dismissing of thoughts when they pop up. Suddenly, the work of Socha is manageable and in fact becomes a routine that's undertaken quickly and efficiently when spills occur. Before you know it, what felt like an enormous archive of waste is a neatly ordered file that fits comfortably anywhere, making you nimble and agile, so as to cleanly address whatever undertaking you're considering. Socha is both mindfulness and meditation. Perhaps you need to undertake some regular meditation sessions to hone your ability to identify when you're about to get caught up in a thought that will catch you in a quicksand of mess. As mentioned before, once you have learned these new neural responses, you will instantly flip into mind maintenance mode and not get buried in a hoarder's paradise. Santosha. After the effort and intensity of undertaking the process of Socha, the next niyama is the far gentler Santosha, or contentment. On the journey to enlightenment, escape from the distraction of material pleasures feels like a safe and still harbour. If ever there was a benchmark for being present, it is Santosha, as contentment indicates that right here, right now, all is well. Contentment can't be passed in the idea that you'll be content once you acquire something else or achieve another goal. I believe contentment is the best indicator that you are working through the eight limbs and assimilating the learnings, as wherever there is yearning or discontent, there is residual attachment, and clearly you are yet to completely release yourself from the idea that external things and achievements are defining you and your happiness. Contentment in your good hustle sits in the knowing that you are living in Dharma. Santosha in your good hustle building blocks comes from knowing that you have a limited view of what is possible, and within the narrow confines of experience and imagination, there is a vast repertoire of alternate outcomes, events, and endings. So living in your Dharma means that you follow the sense where you are most in flow. In this mindset of Santosha, when your good hustle ideas meet with a curveball or a roadblock, there's a deep mental and physical sense of well-being, because you know that whatever is happening is right. The redirect is just a recalibration of your worldview into a new way of thinking and being. You're not attached to what you thought was going to happen, as you know that you could only see a fraction of the possibilities. Achieving Santosha is a function of learning how to be happy with whatever is. A super easy statement to make, but as with everything in the eight limbs, it requires a constant and dedicated process of awareness and discipline around what is real and what is unreal. Where we have given value, meaning, and power to material things, which are by their nature impermanent, this is the unreal. Where happiness comes from people, sensations, or experiences, which are by their nature impermanent, this is the unreal. Only change and impermanence are real. It is a constant vigilance that our minds don't sneak back to their habitual patterns. Consider this in relation to good hustle, especially if you are at the ideation stage. Everything is going to seem pretty unreal, and most of what you know will be based only on perception. This is where agility comes in. When everything is impermanent, it is easy to rapidly change, as it is essentially what you expect to do. This isn't to say that happiness and other sensations and situations can't be experienced. The subtle difference is the understanding that happiness doesn't come from expectations about objects or experiences. It comes from a sense of connection, of oneness, and of, ultimately, santosha. As soon as you start classifying objects or experiences, including people, into categories of good or bad, happy or sad, you are creating an imaginary subjectivity where you cling to one and push away from the other, both of which create attachment and thus suffering. The project is to experience everything without the swings, the highs and lows, simply with surrender and contentment. This seems impossible, doesn't it? Our minds are so conditioned to constantly judge and classify everything and everyone, accepting and rejecting, reifying or demonizing, working away as if we are in charge of and responsible for it all, which in itself is exhausting. No wonder we are increasingly anxious and reactive and far away from santosha so much of the time. Santosha may well be a distinct niyama, however, it's also a checkpoint. When santosha is present and constant in our lives, we have achieved the preconditions for adapting to the remaining niyamas. Tapas. Which brings us to tapas, or austerities. For most new businesses, the pathway from idea to market is a period of time where money is going out far more quickly than it's coming in. Some of that money will be spent on research and development, testing markets, trying different angles in advertising and marketing, and making prototypes. This is expenditure where the return on investment is not a boomerang. It is also completely normal. The majority of businesses, even if they have a short pathway between concept and sale, are revenue negative or neutral at the outset. Planning and budgeting for this period of time through exercising some austerities definitely makes it easier to keep the dream alive without falling into the chasm of worry and concern that comes with the early part of venture creation. Our Western understanding of austerities and suffering simply doesn't allow these definitions to be anything but pejorative. We live in a state where our whole existence is geared towards the acquisition of material goods, sense enjoyment, and emotional comfort. The idea that austerity is a choice and can be highly beneficial to our quest for happiness or contentment is anathema to our understanding of existence. Austerities in yoga and in the Good Hustle are what could be described as blessings in disguise. I'd go so far to say that they don't even require a disguise. They are blatant advantages. By being able to release attachment to sense pleasures and go without, you are able to clearly see the real from the unreal and let go of what doesn't serve you. In the Yoga Sutras, tapas, like sosha, can be both physical and mental. Captured in the type of austerities practiced by yogis are material things like restriction on food, quantity and type, on comfort more generally, warmth and soft beds, and on actions and interactions of the mind, such as thoughts and behaviours. Throughout this book is the possibly maddening by now mantra that meditation and mind management are the gateway activities to happiness. If you are at the starting blocks without an existing practice, and let's assume we are all still happily or unhappily wallowing in lives rich with samsara, some austerities are necessary. Undertaking austerities is the initial pathway to our neural reprogramming. Getting out of your cozy bed in the dark of morning to meditate is an austerity. You are giving up warmth and sleep to sit still, breathe, concentrate, and develop the mental discipline necessary. And it doesn't end there. If you are like me, with a love of, read, shocking attachment to, food, and your life revolves around planning and executing delicious meals, it is an absolute austerity measure to shift from food as entertainment, status, pleasure, and companion to it being fuel for the body. Austerity alert! Add into the mix prohibitions on killing and violence, as required in the first yama ahimsa, and you are also saying goodbye to eating animals and fish and, depending on your level of dedication, eggs and dairy too. Oh, and then there's alcohol, variously a stimulant or intoxicant, and not a feature of the yogic lifestyle. There is a continuum of shock and no that many of us feel at the thought of giving up these parts of our cultural practices, which seems so essentially human and so necessary to fit into our various groups and tribes, most of which have eating and drinking at their celebratory center. Our collective cultural obsession with food is bordering on obscene, yet we rarely question the reason that eating and entertaining is our new place of worship. All this digestive attachment and grasping is considered a significant impediment to spiritual practice. Here, the difficulty of austerity is wildly amplified because we have such a tsunami of enjoyment to constantly decline. At the point where you are ready, you may find, as I did, that what once seemed to be the most difficult or impossible task simply feels right, and you begin the process of decoupling from your food affair. What was once an austerity becomes the new normal, as does getting up early, feeling compassion for the greater mass of humans in all their complexity, and looking beyond the needs of one to the needs of all. When your mind and body aren't consumed by consuming, there is much more space to devote to good hustling. In many spiritual traditions, fasting is a regular part of practice to bring clarity and concentration for meditation, and food reduction, or at least mindfulness, is a great habit to get into. This is where the practice of tapas needs some good PR. We need to embrace and seek out opportunities to exercise our discipline muscles. Saying no to the things that distract us, and at worst derail us, is a choice to be celebrated. Initially, you have to move through the pain of letting go. Once we have deprogrammed the addiction behavior, we begin to experience the calm and constant feeling of deep contentment. The long-term adoption of austerities has many benefits aside from enhanced spiritual capacity. There are significant savings to be made by not indulging ourselves every time we slip from sensory euphoria into the depression of non-gratification. Add it up. Drinking, partying, shopping, it all costs money. Productivity gains go through the roof. Waking up every day feeling fresh and full of juice is incredible, and that enjoyment doesn't diminish. When you have awareness about consumption as a panacea for suffering, you make better choices about what you really need. Our bodies get better with yoga or any kind of regular physical practice. Our minds get better with regular meditation. Together, with removing the rubbish from our bodies and our habits and building our mind muscles, what was an austerity becomes like a jackpot. We've just switched up our worldview. Suddenly month-long retreats, upping our hours on the yoga mat or meditation cushion, and giving up those residual dietary treats don't seem like an extreme sport. They seem desirable. And right about here, the place where we couldn't possibly give up our jobs, take a pay cut, and risk everything to follow the dream of our Dharma, suddenly seems to be achievable. We are no longer slaves to desire and attachment. We are the bosses of our own minds. This is the point at which it all makes sense, and the words about self-discipline and doing the mind work that were empty and academic become the point of transition. It is more than talk about journeys or steps along a path. It is an embodied and emboldened lived experience with real, tangible benefits, not dependent on something outside of us. This is a moment of realization we need to savor, as it is a significant point of acknowledgement of how much we are the authors of our own happiness and suffering. Let me note again, this isn't about creating a life without comfort or ease, far from it. It is about navigating through an awareness of how much we sleepwalk through life with the soporific effects of our favorite distractions and numbing tools constantly at hand. Austerities are essential when reprioritizing your life to get you to a place of living in Dharma, and they definitely can't make you feel like you are in lack or in loss. They should feel empowering and driven by choice. Austerities at this point in time in your good hustle can be about finding ways to save and minimize expenditure so you have a comfortable buffer. You need to be able to withstand any unplanned blowouts that might, actually, definitely, will happen. The austerities you go through will also be personal. If you are working another job and building your good hustle dream around the fringes of the day, you may find you have little free time, as every moment will be taken up nibbling away at your goals, especially while managing family and life and keeping up spiritual practices. Sleep can be sacrificed and is a small price to pay for being able to carve out a couple of precious extra hours in the day. You need to adopt a single-pointed approach to the world. At every opportunity, ask yourself if what you're about to do gets you closer to your goal. Once you've landed on your business idea and have mapped out a tentative pathway to get your idea to market, You'll be faced with daily distractions and decisions. I've seen it happen over and over again. When the light of creativity and entrepreneurialism is switched on, suddenly the tsunami of opportunities flows in, and your simple idea becomes the generator of many, many new tangents. I like to call this dilemma opportunitis, and it is a disease that can be terminal to a project if left untreated.